This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Before Nelson Mandela was the celebrated leader of the post-apartheid South Africa, he was a prisoner. His government considered him a saboteur and a revolutionary. He was put on trial in 1963, a trial that would end with him spending 27 years in prison. Could have been worse. At the time of the so-called Rivonia trial, everybody thought Nelson Mandela would be executed. UNC Law Professor Kenneth Brown got interested in the Rivonia trial after visiting South Africa in the mid-1980s. He wondered what would have happened if Mandela had indeed gone to the gallows. He's written a book called Saving Nelson Mandela, The Rivonia Trial and the Fate of South Africa. And Kenneth Brown joins us now. Welcome, Ken. Good to have you here.
Delighted to be here, Frank. Thanks very much.
So how's a law school professor from North Carolina end up writing a book about a 1963 trial in South Africa?
I started going to South Africa in 1986 to teach trial advocacy, examination of witnesses, arguments to the court, to a very small group of lawyers, the black lawyers of South Africa. There were only about 100 out of a bar of 6,000. And we began training programs. I was with Jim Ferguson, the noted civil rights lawyer from Charlotte, and he and I taught in those programs each year for about 25 years. When we first came over, there were several white lawyers and judges who were helping us train. Among them were two lawyers named George Bezos and Arthur Chaskelson. Both of them had been among the team representing Mandela at the 1963-64 Rivonia trial. And they were very impressive lawyers. And I got to know them and started to talk to them about the case, what had happened, what the situation had been, how did the trial turn out the way that it turned out. In 1990, when Mandela was released from prison and began his incredibly impressive leadership that led to the end of apartheid and to the emergence of democracy, I started thinking to myself, what would have happened in South Africa had he not been around, had he been hanged in 1964, which was certainly a real possibility. So I combined that with my friendship with George and Arthur, talked to them some more, met some other people who had been involved in the trial, went back, started reading transcripts of the trial, started reading the memoirs of people who had been involved in the trial, and the book emerged this year.
It is remarkable to see the amount of evidence against the defendants, Nelson Mandela being among several, in that case.
There was an incredible amount of evidence. Part of it was a result of some very sloppy security on the part of this group that was attacking the government. At that point, they were planning sabotage with no intent to harm individuals. But they had begun to gather all sorts of weapons, of explosives, I should say, at this farm in the Johannesburg suburb of Rivonia. And they had literally hundreds of documents, including some handwritten by Nelson Mandela, and including a document called Operation Moyabaya, which had plans for guerrilla warfare and the eventual joining of the rebels by unnamed outside powers. The complex was raided in 1963, and it was all there. And they literally picked it up, and that's was the basis of it. Mandela was actually in prison at the time. He was not at the complex, but there were documents in his handwriting, and he was brought back from Robben Island to face these further and possibly capital charges.
Your introduction to this book is wonderful because it's a great guide to the 20th century in South Africa, its evolution from the Boer War between the British colonialists and the kind of native Afrikaners.
Right.
But it also traces the evolution of the ANC, which started out as a nonviolent organization in 1912.
The ANC was purely political. It had argued for greater rights for black people throughout its existence. It began to become more militant in the 1940s with the leadership of Nelson Mandela and Walter Sisulu, who was also one of the defendants at the Rivonia trial. And through the 1950s, it continued more aggressive political demonstrations and so on. There was an incident in 1960, which was the turning point, I think, in lots of ways, called the Sharpsville Massacre, where some 70 blacks were shot, many in the back, by the South African police. At that point, the ANC was declared illegal. Other groups were illegal. The South African Communist Party was already illegal. Mandela and Oliver Tambo, who was the leader, went underground. And at that point, the policy of the ANC changed from politics to the planning of more militant operations. Initially sabotage, but there was certainly the possibility that guerrilla warfare, terrorism might in fact occur.
And you talked about the Sharpeville Massacre in 1960, but these were not just isolated events. In 1948, the country, the nation of South Africa, took a turn to the right.
It did. What happened in 1948 was the election of the National Party, which was an Afrikaner-dominated party. The Afrikaners had been felt abused, I think, with some justification by the English speakers. This was their turn, and they were going to preserve their culture, but also were much more militant on the subject of black rights than the English had been. There was de facto segregation. Don't get me wrong. The English had their own form of racism, but the Afrikaners institutionalized it, and they put in apartheid, which what we would think of as segregation was only a minor part of it. This was an attempt to make sure that no black was educated above the level of a domestic servant, and to make all black citizens of homelands, or Bantustans, as they call them, and to make sure that they were citizens of those homelands and not citizens of South Africa, which, of course, made them aliens in their own country.
Right. They had to carry working documents.
Passes, laws, et cetera. Yeah.
So all of this coincides with the increasing militancy of the ANC and its friendship then with the Communist Party.
Right. During the 1940s and into the early 1950s, there was a resistance on the part of the ANC, the African National Congress, to alliance with any group that they viewed as white-dominated or as non-black-dominated. And that included the Communist Party. There were lots of black communists, but it was white-dominated. Mandela and Sisulu decided they needed allies wherever they could get them, and they formed alliances with the Communist Party. Some of the ANC people were also communists, but they formed an organization called Umkhonto weSizwe, and that was the militant arm, and it was a combination of the ANC and the Communist Party.
And that's how Mandela ended up at this house where the raid took place and the
documents
right. were taken.
Well, he had been there earlier. As I say, he was in prison at that time, but he had been a frequent visitor, generally disguised as a gardener. But he would come in and out of Lily's Leaf Farm. Yeah.
So the documentary evidence is overwhelming. There's an indictment, and yet, and here's where we get to some of the characters in this trial, the prosecution sort of failed to link the individual defendants with the actual bits of evidence, which was a kind of a slack indictment.
It was the first indictment was faulty legally, and I think it gives you some insight into the South African legal system. There at least was the superficial attention to forms of justice, and the defense team, led by the brilliant Bram Fischer, was successful in having the first indictment dismissed. The same judge that tried the case dismissed the indictment, much to the chagrin of the prosecutor. But the defendants were immediately rearrested. The next indictment, which was only slightly better, was upheld, and they were brought to trial.
Which you said that it may have had an interesting effect in the court of world opinion, in the sense that it gave the impression that, yes, there is, in fact, a functioning legal system here.
I think that the South African government's propaganda actually benefited from that, because it did give the rest of the world the feeling, well, this is a fair system. This is a fair judge. I don't know that that was a deliberate attempt. Right. I don't know that that was government rigged, but it certainly was something that they could articulate as evidence that the judicial system was still working.
And in terms of that, the judicial system itself, you point out in the book that, in fact, it was separate from the government. However, it was populated by people who were saturated with.
Exactly right. I think that the judge who tried the case, Cortes de Wet, who was himself an Afrikaner, was not a member of the ruling party. He had been a member of the United Party, which is Jan Smuts' party, which was racist by modern standards, but certainly a step below the National Party. He was independent of the government. I think that's pretty clear. Most people involved in the trial believe that. However, he had all of the prejudices and all of the fears of most of the white population, particularly the Afrikaner population.
He's quite a character, and he went back and forth in terms of trying
to read
this judge.
Well, he was very difficult to predict, and that's one of the brilliance of the lawyering. He would go from chiding the prosecutor over this indictment to chiding the prosecutor. The prosecutor was a guy named Percy Uttar, who viewed himself as the most learned lawyer in South Africa and wanted to be called Dr. Uttar. The judge would never call him Dr. Uttar, and he would sneer at him. But at times in the trial, he seemed to be joining him in his cross-examination of the defendant. He seemed to enjoy the attacks on the noted author Alan Payton, who spoke in mitigation, and he was laughing and during that examination. And so it was very hard to predict, and the lawyers had a great deal of difficulty figuring where he was going. He didn't like the prosecutor. He didn't much like the defendants, but he was going to go the way that he wanted to go.
And you suggest this is the brilliance of it, particularly the lead defense attorney in this case.
That's right. Bram Fischer is perhaps the most interesting character in all of legal history, in my judgment. He was himself an Afrikaner. He not only was an Afrikaner, but he was the grandson of the president of one of the Boer republics. He could have been president of South Africa himself. He was also a leading lawyer. He represented all the big mining companies, the diamond companies, and so on. He was also an ardent communist. And he himself had been involved in this Umkhonto Wazizwe, and the only reason why he wasn't arrested on that day, he just didn't happen to be there. But he was a brilliant lawyer. Tragically, he was the only one involved in the Rivonia trial to die in prison. He was arrested himself, charged under the same sabotage act that Mandela and the others were charged, and he was eventually convicted and sentenced to prison for life, and he died in prison.
So the big question, why, given all the evidence? And the fact is, in a way, the trial ended on the first day because Nelson Mandela spoke.
Nelson Mandela spoke from the dock, as they say. He didn't testify. He spoke from the dock, given what they call an allocution. It's not evidence in the case, but in a trial without a jury, it really didn't matter. He was speaking to the judge. And in that speech, which lasted 4 hours, incidentally, he outlined the history of the ANC and admitted to the court that he had planned sabotage. He and the others, the leadership at least, had sent young men abroad for guerrilla warfare training, but underlined the reasons why that was done, that the government had left them no other choice. They had tried the political way of doing it, and it just didn't work.
And outlined three stages, from sabotage to guerrilla warfare, ultimately to revolution, if the first two didn't pay off.
He said they were at stage two. Stage one was politics. Stage two was sabotage. Stage three was terrorism. And stage four was a full-scale guerrilla war.
So that should have done it. That could have hanged him right then and there.
It could have hanged him. But one of the reasons, I think, why the court spared his life was the incredible impression that he made on the court and everyone. Even one of the white South African newspapers printed his speech in full. And he makes a remarkable case for why he was doing what he was doing.
And it gets summed up very well in the very last paragraph, which I will ask you to read for us.
Yeah, this is a very famous paragraph, and these words are now up on the wall of the new constitutional court in Johannesburg. After talking about all of this history and his goal of racial harmony, he says the following, and these are his words: "During my lifetime, I have dedicated myself to the struggle of the African people. I have fought against white domination, and I have fought against black domination. I have cherished the ideal of a democratic and free society in which all persons live together in harmony and with equal opportunities. It is an ideal which I hope to live for and see realized, but if needs be, it's an ideal for which I am prepared to die." It's interesting, the words but if needs be were added by one of his young lawyers, George Bezos. He said, "Don't tell the judge to sentence you to death." But years later, Dennis Goldberg, who was the only white convicted, asked Mandela why he thought he didn't get the death penalty. And Mandela's response was, "Because I dared the judge to give it to me."
Well, that said, if you believe that, was it because of this particular judge, or do you think that his reason and that speech was compelling?
I think his reasoning was compelling, but it was not Mandela alone. I think the other defendants, particularly Walter Sisulu, Govan Mbeki, who is the father of the future South African president, Thabo Mbeki, took the stand. The prosecutor chose to argue politics with them. And the prosecutor, again, thought of himself as brilliant. And they, as they say in Athletic, wiped the floor with him. They clearly lost. And it was hard, I think, for the judge to see these men as anything other than devoted patriots and men of substance. I think the lawyering was brilliant in that they would admit those things that had to be admitted and attack those things which were critical. They were successful in convincing the judge that there were no plans to hurt anyone and that no one had, in fact, ever been hurt by any of their acts. No individual had ever been harmed. And that whatever the possibilities of guerrilla warfare were, they had not been decided on. And those were critical. And they were successful in that respect.
Kenneth Brown, wonderful book. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Well, thanks very much for having me, Frank. I appreciate it.
Kenneth Brown is a professor emeritus at the University of North Carolina Law School. The new book is called Saving Nelson Mandela, The Rivonia Trial and the Fate of South Africa. Ken's going to be at McIntyre's Books in Pittsburgh on April 14th. Just ahead, are the pictures you don't take more compelling than the ones you do? Find out on The State of Things.